Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 98, and I believe that my informal count tags it as the 33rd autopsy episode in the autopsy series. Wow. It's been a marathon of sorts, hasn't it? And what I am about to say next may excite you even more. Episode 98 and 99 will be the last couple of episodes on the autopsy. We'll close this chapter and say goodbye to the topic and head west to the Golden Gate. I've been threatening to do that, to finish up the autopsy series for about 10 episodes now, and I just couldn't seem to do it. We covered a lot of ground in the autopsy, but not all of it. There were a few witnesses that we left out, some really good ones too. Tom Robinson from Gawler's funeral home, Sandra Spencer, the photo lab technician who printed and saw autopsy pictures that clearly weren't in the autopsy collection. This area of the story is so rich that you can continue to pull on a string, almost any of the loose strings of the autopsy, and you will eventually have, well, your own ball of cotton. But we covered enough ground for sure. And in the last episode that you just listened to, listening to Doug Horn's anthology and timeline of what he believes happened, well, I hope that helped you to summarize it all and put it all in proper context in your mind. And maybe some or most, if not all, of Horn's rendition is what truly happened. Well, if that version of the truth is anything close to what truly happened that night, may God help us all. You just can't write this stuff. That story was fantastic enough without the mention of a nefarious act by a Secret Service agent. But Horn wasn't finished until he made a clear implication of Secret Service agent Roy Kellerman's involvement as the man on the ground orchestrating the logistics of that cover-up. Almost hard to believe, and certainly mind-blowing. If it's true, was it a case of blindly following orders with Kellerman? Because someone told him that we were on the brink of World War III and it was for the good of the country? Or was there more to it? These are key questions that remain unanswered even today, if the rest of Horn's version of the story is true. Well, that brings us to today's episode and the last couple of episodes on this one final autopsy topic, the final topic in this rather thrilling series. It's about Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. Why are we ending the autopsy episodes with this story is, well, simple. The mystery and the maze of the autopsy is deep. One thing must be evident by now, evident after 97 episodes, that there were nefarious things going on at various moments during the various events of the assassination story. And the witnesses were in danger if they harbored material facts that would reveal something significant about the conspiracy or the cover-up, and if the conspirators knew who they were. Most everybody involved in the Kennedy assassination as a principal witness had real thoughts of fear come across their mind at one moment or another. After all, if they, whoever they is, would kill the president, well, then they would surely kill a witness. You know, time does what it always does for most crimes. It dulls the senses, twists recollections, and for most involved, it reduces the will of the pursuers. And then, finally, as principal actors die off, it eliminates some of the real danger, real risk that witnesses perceive or that is present. That is the fear of coming forward and testifying. And then, if you are lucky, the real truth begins to come out. In the 1970s, the prosecution of drug cases involving the Medellin cartel might be a good example of this, where it was very clear that if you were involved in one of these cases during that time, as a witness, or even a prosecutor or a judge, you were in real danger, the danger of losing your life. Even worse, your family could be in danger too. It's hard for most of us to wrap our head around the idea of living in a civilized society and yet being subjected to the evil and the dangers that lurk in our society, lurk like that, in broad daylight. But it's reality, and it really does exist. Well, the story of William Bruce Pitzer represents the story of danger and intrigue for a witness in the JFK assassination story. And Lieutenant Commander Pitzer may very well have lost his life because of what he did related to the autopsy, what he then knew about the forces at work in the assassination, and what he was going to do with evidence in his possession. And if you thought Doug Horn's story in episode 97 was far out and fantastic, well, stay tuned because we are going higher and faster in this final set of autopsy episodes that cover Pitzer. As jurors, you will have to sort it all out, what parts are true and what it means and how it comports with everything else that you have heard and all that you know. Not to tip you off in advance, but in this last autopsy episode, it's interesting that the CIA begins to show up in the story. Imagine that. Most of the material in today's episode is based on the story told in the book Without Smoking Gun, written by Kent Hiler, but it also draws on other prominent assassination books and records as well, including JFK and The Unspeakable by Jim Douglas. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 98 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. This is the story of Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer, who, in 1966, was found shot to death in his office at the Bethesda National Naval Medical Center. That was the same building complex where the president's autopsy had been performed. His death was ruled a suicide. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Jack Stover is one of the naval execs who identified the body. Stover should be well known to you from earlier episodes of JFK, The Enduring Secret. It's also a story of Lieutenant Commander Dennis David, a close friend of Pitzer's and a character that you now know well from some of the other previous autopsy episodes as well. You will know a little more about him after this set of episodes. Commander David recalls that day in 1963, shortly after the assassination and autopsy, where his mentor, Bill Pitzer, showed him a medical film and photographs of President John F. Kennedy's dead body. And what they saw, and what they both concluded after they saw it, was that the president had clearly been shot from the front, despite what the American public was being told. There is another more far-out and fantastic portion of this story, a less credible piece of this story. And it's the story of Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, who is a retired Green Beret and veteran of two wars, a man that claims he was asked by the CIA to assassinate William Pitzer on the basis that Pitzer committed treason and espionage. But if this story is true, then the real reason the CIA wanted him dead is that he had the Kennedy film and pictures, and he was about to go public with what he knew. Marvin did not accept the assignment, as the story goes, but the idea that such a moment even occurred and the thought that someone else did accept the assignment and that William Pitzer was killed because he had these materials in his possession and he was going to use them, killed by the CIA because he was going to get the truth out to the American people, well, that is bone-chilling, and it's certainly the stuff that novels are made of. How much of all this is true? We'll leave that to you as a juror to figure out, but you really can't write this stuff, and it really is a fitting way to finish off the story of the autopsy. In some ways, the more public side of this story begins with a confidential teletype sent from the Baltimore field office of the FBI to the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. in the early morning hours of October 30th, 1966. This is what the teletype said. Urgent. To the director of the FBI. William Bruce Pitzer was the victim of a crime on a government reservation, and it was death by gunshot wound. The victim was a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy stationed at the National Naval Medical Center, Bethesda, Maryland, and he was found dead 10/29/66, at 7:50 p.m. in the TV production studio in NNMC, his working area, with a gunshot wound in the head and his body lying face down on the floor in a pool of blood with a .38 caliber revolver laying close to the body. The revolver contains one spent cartridge, one live round, and one blank cartridge. Three blank cartridges are of the type in the gun and were found on top of the victim's desk in an envelope. Victim had checked out revolver approximately 1 week ago from security office at NNMC to use as a gimmick in connection with training lectures and had so used recently. Victim left home in mid-afternoon 10/29/66 around 4 and traveled to NNMC to see his son, who was playing ball at NNMC, and to get a haircut. When he did not return home for dinner, wife called NNMC security office to locate him. Wife mentioned after body found to victim's superior officer that victim had recently complained of back trouble and stated he intended to see a doctor. Victim attended funerals last week of two Navy friends and commented, "I wonder who the third will be." Autopsy tentatively scheduled for 8 a.m. on 10/30. Investigation being conducted. Okay, let's pause there now that you have heard the whole teletype. Well, that was a sobering teletype, wasn't it? Or at least a few sentences of it. I wonder who the third person will be. You know, for many years, my dad and I would watch NCIS together. He had watched every episode more than once. I don't know, maybe some of them he even watched 10 times. And those guys were good. Sometimes in real life, it works that way. And sometimes it does not. For several weeks after the lieutenant commander's death, the FBI assisted the Naval Investigative Services, or NIS as it was known at the time, by interviewing persons of interest and examining the forensic evidence in the case. On the eve of October 30th, a second teletype was sent by the FBI from the Baltimore field office to FBI headquarters. This time, the preliminary results of the autopsy were reported. Lieutenant Commander H.P. Losima, a U.S. Navy medical school doctor who participated in the autopsy, indicated that it was his preliminary opinion prior to completion of all laboratory examinations, which would not be completed for at least a week more, that the death was caused by a gunshot wound in the head from the right temple exiting near the left temple, which is not inconsistent, as he put it, with a self-inflicted shot from a pistol. The report would go on to say that the gun was not resting against the victim's head when the shot was fired, and that the autopsy could not estimate the distance away from the body that the gun was. And there were no marks on the body that were not attributable to a gunshot wound. That is, no scuffle, no struggle before the gunshot happened. The cable went further, saying that there were discussions that had presumably been had with the Pitzer's deceased family, and those discussions furnished no basis to suspect foul play or reasons for suicide. Obviously, a shot that starts on the right and ends on the left, if it was self-induced, would have been taken while holding the gun in the victim's right hand. Which hand the gun was in would prove to be a bit of a controversy, and we'll get to that in a second. Also, later on, we'll find that the FBI concluded that based on the forensic evidence that it was unlikely that the gun was fired any closer than 3 feet away from the victim. Hardly a fact that supported the idea of a suicide. Okay, well, I am getting ahead of myself, so back to the progression of the facts in the case. Commander Rumble of the NIS, under a transmittal letter that went directly to J. Edgar Hoover himself, requested special assistance from the FBI's crime lab on this one. The request had all the usual kinds of things in it. Was the projectile that was obtained from the body the one fired from the revolver that was found on the scene? At what minimum distance would that revolver fail to leave powder burns or embedded powder particles in human flesh? As we just mentioned, a question that was quite relevant if you were considering whether it was possible that Pitzer committed suicide. Similar questions were asked about whether there was any residue in the paraffin casts of his right hand to indicate that Pitzer had held the gun that had been fired. The FBI acted rapidly and dutifully on the vast majority of these requests. The whole issue of which gun hand was used became clouded when Dennis David made a statement later on that he was sure Pitzer was left-handed. He made that statement because he often played cards with Pitzer, and Pitzer would deal cards with his left hand. However, despite this fact, Pitzer's family would confirm that Pitzer was right-handed. On that fact, case closed. Interestingly enough, though, there was one question posed that they did not act on or comment on, and it related to a note that was contained on a slip of paper on a notepad that they had collected from the crime scene and submitted for analysis. The note essentially read as follows, and it said, "Remind me to return the gun to the security office." The obvious question related to the statement was whether or not Pitzer wrote it himself at some point near the moment of his death, perhaps indicating that he did not intend to kill himself with a weapon. Pitzer was a known note-taker, and he had several slips of paper that were gathered and sent for analysis from the crime scene, including one that was taken from the floor near the body and had a partial heel print on it. A partial heel print that the FBI later concluded was not a match for the shoes that Pitzer was wearing that day. Here's another one that intrigues me. A number of written exchanges ensued between NIS and the FBI regarding the physical evidence gathered in the case, and in the end, perhaps one more interesting thing stands out as a material interest for us as listeners today. It relates to the latent fingerprints taken at the site. There were fingerprints lifted from the two chairs between which the body was discovered and from three beer cans found in a wastebasket at the scene. Only four latent fingerprints were good enough to analyze out of a total of 12 prints lifted by authorities. One palm print and one other impression of value were found among the evidence lists submitted by the Navy as well. As to the identity of those prints, the FBI reported the latent prints were not identical with the finger and palm prints of the victim, Pitzer. So, they had to have been someone else. Perhaps even more perplexing were the FBI's findings with regard to latent prints on some of the other items that were sent to the laboratory. There were no useful prints found on any of those items, including the revolver and the spent ammunition and the spent cartridges, the eyeglasses, and the notepad. All would be devoid of any useful prints. In addition, there was no record of latent fingerprints having been lifted from the lock or the handle of the door leading to Pitzer's office. It certainly begged the question of whether someone wiped the place down for prints afterward, but before the authorities got there. But then again, why do that and then leave the beer cans in the trash can with fingerprints on them? So, we may never know on that one, surely. I'm not versed in these things, but it seems as if Pitzer's own prints surely would have been on the door handle. The authorities submitted the prints of eight individuals, presumably a group that was likely to have been in the offices and that were to be ruled out as suspects if their prints were found. But in the end, the forensic evidence would prove inconclusive as to whether he killed himself or whether he was killed by the hand of another. As author Kent Heiner would put it, William Pitzer, the dead body, had little to say about who killed him. But for our audience, there is more, of course, and so we shall now proceed. Despite the absence of any credible physical evidence and no credible motives for suicide or indications of suicidal behavior, the Navy finally focused on a story of dubious veracity and used it to base their conclusion that Pitzer had taken his own life. If one cherry-picks the events of the day, that day in which Pitzer died, you might start at a point around 3:50 p.m. when Pitzer was seen at the Navy Exchange Building's checkout counter buying Camel cigarettes, which his wife had so often encouraged him to give up. But this day, he could not. He was wearing sports-type clothing, probably a jacket, and beige or light-colored pants, according to the FBI's interview of a woman who was, as far as they could determine, the last person to see Pitzer alive. She would go on to say that his hair was messed up and he had a sloppy appearance, and this was entirely out of character for him. She would say that Pitzer looked like a wild man, and she kidded him about his appearance. In her brief conversation with Pitzer, there did not appear to be anything unusual with his attitude, and the exchange took place mere minutes before the estimated time of Pitzer's death, around 4:15. Several employees were asked whether they had heard a gunshot, and none of them recalled hearing a shot, although a gun might have been fired in the soundproofed TV studio without coming to anyone's attention. William Pitzer's widow was interviewed on Sunday by agents of the Naval Investigative Service and the FBI, and she told them that the idea of Bill having taken his own life was incomprehensible to her, explaining that to do so would be completely opposed to his principles and his philosophy. She went on to explain that Bill had given no indications that he was troubled by anything of great significance. No doubt he was taken by the recent deaths of two of his old friends, and perhaps an increased appetite recently for more beer. But all of that didn't add up to suicidal tendencies. On the contrary, he remained generally cheerful and very much involved in all of his life's routine activities until the very hour of his death. We'll see in a minute that there was more to Pitzer's personal circumstances, more than his wife may have known at the time she made those statements. The primary basis for the Navy's eventual finding of suicide was an alleged affair between Lieutenant Commander Pitzer and a woman in Florida brought on by Pitzer's dissatisfaction with his marriage. In a somewhat secondary theme, the Navy's explanation of the suicide also included alleged grief caused Pitzer by his younger son. As Ken Heiner's book points out, these aspects of the case show irregularity in the collection and documentation of supporting testimony, suggesting that the facts may have been distorted by the authorities in this case. But regardless, there does appear to be some problems. Pitzer traveled to Pensacola, Florida, where there is a large naval installation and where investigative reports first surfaced that he went out with a woman a few times. He was a married man, so this meant an affair. And for a man with top secret clearance, that was a matter of interest to the security forces within the Navy. Allegedly, Pitzer met this woman at the Chief's Club. She was in her late 40s and apparently attractive and affluent, and as the investigators documented it, the whole thing blossomed into an intimate relationship by early 1966. There is documentation in the record that they met several times in various locations, with one such soiree happening in Atlanta, Georgia, where they spent several days together. A typewritten transcript included as an enclosure in the Navy's final report is a letter that allegedly is from Pitzer and to this woman, and it was apparently typed shortly before his death. In that letter, he urges her not to write letters to him anymore and that he is in deep trouble at home, but that he does long to be with her. No doubt it does imply that he was quite conflicted and in the middle of a sticky circumstance between his marriage and a lover. But he also mentions problems with one of his sons, including an incident in which his son stole something from a store. Again, hardly the stuff that makes for suicidal tendencies, and certainly not in a man like this. The point of this digression is to highlight some of the documentation that the Navy used in order to come to a conclusion that Commander Pitzer committed suicide, and that his death was not a murder. The Navy's premise was that these items in and of themselves were enough to drive a man of his background and character to suicide. We haven't given you much of his background yet, but it was pretty clear that this was not a man that was likely driven to suicide by these circumstances. He was considered to be a model Navy officer in so many ways, and his community and other involvement made it clear that this man had what it took to overcome difficult circumstances. The totality of his history made it so. Although we all know you really never know what's inside someone's head when it comes to this topic. That is, the topic of suicide. His widow, Joyce Spitzer, remained certain that her husband's death was not a suicide, and she remained apprehensive for many years afterward about talking about it to anyone, even after more than two decades had passed after his death. She had been told not to talk about it by the Navy authorities, and she seemed fearful among other things, of losing her Navy benefits if she, and I quote, stepped out of line. Oh, and there's also the nefarious fact that several days before Pitzer was killed, he was visited by two members of an internal investigation team, curious as to why he was retiring. Regardless of whether the stories about him are true or are exaggerated or outright fabricated about his extramarital affairs, the point is the Navy used this and other elements to support their case that Pitzer died of suicide. When it comes to pistols, Pitzer would teach classes, and at the end of the class, he would shoot a blank out of a .38 caliber pistol, signaling the end of the session. As a result, Pitzer would often carry a .38 revolver. He was not a stranger to firearms on the one hand, but on the other hand, he was not known to carry any live ammunition with the guns. Oh yes, and there's that little thing I just talked about where he got a visit. Well, you see, on the week of his death, Lieutenant Commander Pitzer told Lee Andre that he intended to submit his retirement letter. That prompted Mr. Andre to ask for the revolver back to have it returned to the security office at Bethesda before Pitzer retired. Andre was the one who had signed for the gun in the first place when it was checked out of the general inventory. This was a conversation with Andre that was well documented by the FBI. The FBI report would indicate that Andre had asked him to return the gun on October 25th. Again, it was a .38 caliber Smith & Wesson revolver, and Pitzer was to return it to the NNMC security office. Pitzer had requisitioned it and secured the gun along with six blank cartridges from the security office earlier in the month, on October 12th. As we mentioned earlier, it was to be used by Pitzer as a training prop. Andre had signed for the gun and wanted to return it when it was no longer needed by Pitzer. When Andre asked Pitzer about the return of the gun, Pitzer said that he would take it back to the security office himself, and in Andre's opinion, that was entirely out of character for Pitzer, who usually had enlisted men run all of his errands. I'll mention again that Pitzer left a note that was found at the scene of his death, and it said, "Remind me to return the gun to the security office." Up to this point, all of this is background, of course, for what we really want to talk about and cover in today's episode. William Bruce Pitzer joined the U.S. Navy in 1939. He saw action during the Second World War and the Korean War. He later joined the U.S. Navy Medical Service Corps, and he was eventually appointed Chief of the Educational Television Division of the Naval Medical School at Bethesda. Promoted to the rank of Lieutenant Commander, he was given a senior position at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. How would a person know that this seemingly mundane but successful life trajectory that Pitzer was on would put him straight on a collision path with one of world history's epic events? All of us know that on the 22nd of November, 1963, the autopsy of John F. Kennedy took place right there in offices close to where Pitzer's office was. A few days after the assassination, a colleague of his, Dennis David, whom you have already been introduced to, found Pitzer working on a 16mm film, slides, and black and white photos of the Kennedy autopsy. David noted that those materials showed what appeared to be an entry wound in the right frontal area, with a corresponding exit wound in the lower rear of the skull. Gerald Custer, by now, our well-known x-ray technician at the hospital and present that night at the autopsy taking x-rays of the president, later stated that Pitzer had photographed the proceedings, including the military men who attended the Kennedy autopsy. It was also rumored that Pitzer had copies of Kennedy's autopsy photographs. But, according to Dr. Humes, who was the principal forensic pathologist performing the autopsy that night, Pitzer was not present at the autopsy. In fact, there are many witnesses that testified under oath and otherwise over the years to the effect that Pitzer was not physically present that night in the morgue. Pitzer is also absent from the Siebert and O'Neill FBI report, which contains the inventory listing of those present that night at the autopsy. There were a few transients that were missing off of the Siebert and O'Neill list. We know that from earlier episodes, But had someone been present for extended periods of time during the autopsy and filming the autopsy itself, well, that would have been noted, almost assuredly. And it simply was not the case. However, Humes admitted as part of his testimony that the Bethesda Naval Hospital was equipped with a closed-circuit television system. In fact, there was one in place in the morgue. That was a fact that was previously undisclosed, or at least not readily known, at the time of the assassination. And that closed-circuit television network was the responsibility of William Bruce Pitzer. And over the years, Pitzer had used these facilities to make instructional movies. It is, therefore, possible that Lieutenant Commander Pitzer had secretly made a 16mm movie of the autopsy of President Kennedy's body without being present in the autopsy room when it was carried out. After 28 years in the U.S. Navy, Pitzer decided to retire. He told friends he had been offered a good job working for a network television station. He was about to make a salary of some $45,000 a year, which was quite a large sum of money in those days. And that would be, of course, on top of a Navy pension. And perhaps it was, more importantly, a role, or at least a path to a role, in a major media outlet. It is believed that he intended to make a program about the Kennedy assassination. And it was also just around this time that the Kennedy family was relinquishing private ownership of certain elements of the autopsy materials, materials that were in their possession, and they were remanding them now under a deed of gift to the National Archives. The assassination evidence environment at that moment was about to get more interesting, with the prospect that some of the autopsy materials were about to become more readily accessible to researchers, and thus some of the material might possibly be called out as forgeries if alternative versions of photographs or damning videos in contrast to those photographs were available, and which comparisons against them could be made. There was a real danger developing for those involved with the autopsy. What happened that night? Did Pitzer really make the movie in question? The story appears to have gone like this. At 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, November 22, 1963, 3 hours after President Kennedy was shot in Dallas, Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer received a phone call at his home in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Pitzer was the head of the audiovisual department of the Navy Medical School. In his audiovisual expertise, Pitzer worked closely with Bethesda Naval Hospital, where the president's autopsy was about to take place. After listening to his caller, Bill Pitzer hung up. He excused himself from his family's dinner table and said he was going to work. Pitzer took with him that night his 35mm camera. He did not return home until the next afternoon. He did not discuss with his family the work that he had done in the meantime. On the Monday or Tuesday following the assassination, First Class Hospital Corpsman Dennis David, who later became a lieutenant commander himself, stopped by the office of his good friend and mentor, Lieutenant Commander Bill Pitzer. David found Pitzer only to find him crouched over a film editing machine. "Come here," said Pitzer. "I want to show you something." On the editing machine was about two-thirds of a 16mm reel of film. As Pitzer hand-cranked the film, the black-and-white film, through the machine, David watched the short movie on a small screen. The camera's narrow point of view was above and to the right of President Kennedy's body. The camera point of view did not change, and it was steady as if it was mounted. What Dennis David then saw was the body of President Kennedy viewed from the waist up, being touched by the hands of unseen individuals. He saw the hands roll the body onto its side and back, and this film had been taken before the Y incision had been made on the president's torso. Pitzer was editing the film. David watched him work on several reels. He got the impression, he said, that Pitzer was pulling some of the frames off of the films to make slides with. In addition to the film, Pitzer had pictures and slides on his desk. They showed the president's body from different aspects. Pitzer shared his photographic evidence with David. The two men talked over what they were seeing. David recalled to an interviewer his and Pitzer's conclusions. Number one, it was our distinct impression, hell, it was our opinion, actual opinion, that the shot that killed the president had to have come from the front. Asked why, David said, because we both noted a small entry wound here. And at that moment, indicating that David was pointing to the right side of his forehead, and a large exit wound back in this area, now indicating the right rear of the head. David said, I had seen gunshot wounds before, and so had Bill. I've seen a lot of them since, and I can assure you that it definitely was an entry wound in the forehead. That he and Pitzer were looking at an exit wound in the rear of Kennedy's head was even more obvious. It is inconceivable, he said, that anyone, even vaguely acquainted with gunshot wounds, would conclude that the massive wound in the rear of JFK's skull could have occurred from a rear entry projectile, unless it was from a grenade or mortar shrapnel, which tears and ruins flesh and bone rather than pierces it. Pitzer did not tell David he had taken the film he was editing, but David assumed he had. I never asked him, David said. He was head of the audiovisual department. I just assumed he had done it, that he had taken it. TV footage is usually taken at 30 frames per second, and the transfer of those images onto 16mm film recorded at 24 frames per second makes the transfer difficult and probably resulted in film that was less than high quality. But Pitzer had done it before and knew how to do it. Bill Pitzer's film of John F. Kennedy's body has never been found. One investigator hypothesized that Pitzer had stored the film in his TV production studio's false ceiling. The upright ladder under which his head was found after his death was seen as a clue. It could have been the means by which Pitzer or an assassin climbed up to retrieve the film from its hiding place the final afternoon of Pitzer's life. And of course, the real question is, was he then shot to death with the film vanishing? What Dennis David says was on Bill Pitzer's film contradicts not only the Warren report, but also the increasingly challenged official photographs and x-rays of the autopsy, as well as the questionable testimony of Drs. Humes, Boswell, and Fink. If David is right, the Pitzer film and photographs would constitute powerful evidence of a systematic government cover-up of the gunshot wounds. Pitzer himself would have been a critical witness to the process whereby he either took or obtained the government incriminating movie and photographs of the president's body. Dennis David's recollections of the autopsy and of Pitzer's materials were first made public in an anonymous 1975 interview with the Waukegan, Illinois News Sun. Since that time, Pitzer's name has appeared in many printed or televised lists of suspicious deaths, having an alleged connection to the Kennedy assassination. This is where the story gets even more interesting and certainly more bizarre. Colonel Dan Marvin, U.S. Army retired, claimed that when he saw such a list in 1993, it brought back to his memory an incident in the summer of 1965 in which he was asked by the Central Intelligence Agency to kill Pitzer. In August 1965, Dan Marvin told Joyce Pitzer, Pitzer's widow, that the CIA had asked him, as an elite special forces officer, a Green Beret, to assassinate her husband, an assignment he then refused, but that someone else apparently accepted. A government plot that Bill Pitzer's family and friends had long feared was the cause of his death was now finally being filled in, 3 decades later, by a man who almost participated in it. Colonel Dan Marvin told a story that has subsequently caused him to be dismissed by skeptics, denounced and expelled by the Special Forces Association of Retired Soldiers, and begged by his family to retreat into silence. Yet as a born-again Christian, Marvin has insisted on the need to repent of his covert action past, partly by acknowledging to Joyce Pitzer and to the American public how close he came to assassinating her husband. Dan Marvin was an ironic candidate to assassinate a JFK witness. Marvin had volunteered for the Special Forces on November 22, 1963. It was out of my respect for President Kennedy, he said, and because of his respect for the U.S. Army's Special Forces. The curriculum that Marvin then followed at the Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, included, he said, training not only in guerrilla warfare, but also in assassination and terrorism. I believed that extreme measures were sometimes necessary in the interests of national security, he would say. For their top secret training in assassinations, Dan Marvin and his Green Beret classmates were taken, he said, to a different building, one that had double barbed wire fence surrounded by guard dogs. The instruction they received in this high security compound gave them a different view of history. In the first week of August 1965, Colonel Clarence W. Patton, commanding officer of the 6th Special Forces Group, summoned the then-Captain Dan Marvin to an office in Fort Bragg headquarters. Marvin says Colonel Patton told him to meet a company man in an area adjacent to headquarters. Marvin has described this meeting in the shade of some nearby pine trees with a slender man of about 5 feet 10 inches tall, dressed casually in short sleeves, light slacks, and sunglasses appropriate for the August heat. He flashed his ID and took me aside. He asked, would I terminate a man who was preparing to give state secrets to the enemy, a traitor in the making? Marvin, already trained as an assassin, said he would. He assumed his target would be in Southeast Asia, where he was on orders to go in December 1965. Marvin asked the CIA man who the traitor was. I was told, Marvin said, he was a Navy officer, a Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer. The agent told me that Pitzer worked at Bethesda Naval Hospital. He said nothing of a link with the JFK autopsy, and I just assumed that Pitzer was one of those sorry types that went wrong and was going to sell secrets to our enemy. The job had to be done at Bethesda before the man retired from the Navy. It was only at this point that Dan Marvin refused the trigger role in the plot against Pitzer. He had no objection, he confessed later, to killing Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, so long as the deed were to be done abroad, not in the United States. According to Marvin, it was common knowledge in Mafia and CIA circles that Green Berets were tapped by the company to terminate selected targets in foreign countries, whereas the Mafia provided the CIA's pool of able assassins for hits in the U.S. Marvin's assassination skills, he had been taught, would be used overseas, not on our home turf. So, I refused the mission after he'd already told me the guy's name, which is not a good thing. Marvin and the CIA agent parted with the understanding that the name would be as good as forgotten by me. The agent then simply turned around and walked over to meet Captain David Van Eck, who was waiting just out of earshot, and I headed back to my office. Whether or not that agent offered Van Eck, with whom Marvin had taken assassination training with, whether he had been offered the same mission or whether or not he accepted the mission is only for him to say. Marvin would say, I have neither seen him nor heard of him these past 29 years. Dan Marvin began trying to find David Van Eck in April 1993. Following his conversion to the Christian faith, Marvin began speaking out against the CIA's and the Special Forces training in assassination. He hoped Van Eck would corroborate the assassination classes they attended together at Fort Bragg and would help him bring that evil to light. Drawing on Army orders for a training assignment that included both Van Eck and himself, Marvin provided Van Eck's Army service number in a query to the Veterans Services Directorate of the Army Reserve Personnel Center. For over a year, he got no response. In the meantime, he was given a shocking revelation. While watching a documentary on the Kennedy assassination in November 1993, Marvin suddenly felt extremely ill when he saw the name of William Bruce Pitzer flash across his screen. Pitzer's name was one in a list of violent deaths linked with the JFK assassination and cover-up. Marvin was transported back to the shade of those Fort Bragg pine trees where the CIA man in dark glasses asked him to kill the traitor, William Bruce Pitzer, a man who was preparing to give state secrets to the enemy. Marvin realized the assignment he refused under those trees must have been carried out by someone else. That could have been his Green Beret classmate, David Van Eck, to whom the CIA agent had spoken next. Following the revelation of Pitzer's death, Marvin redoubled his efforts to find Van Eck. After informing the Veterans Services Directorate that he might have to seek the help of members of Congress, Marvin finally received a reply in December 1994. It stated their office had been unable to identify a service of record for the person concerned. Marvin feared Van Eck was dead, that there had been a second murder through a CIA double cross. He worried that his Green Beret comrade, David Van Eck, had not only killed William Pitzer, but that he had been killed in turn and his records obliterated to complete a cover-up. However, in 1996, the Assassination Records Review Board, the ARRB, following leads of researchers, located David Van Eck. ARRB staff members interviewed him by phone. Dr. David Van Eck was by then a colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve Medical Corps. He had indeed attended the same January through April 1964 session of the Special Warfare School that Dan Marvin had, but said he could not remember Marvin. "I'm not familiar with that name," he said. Asked if he recalled attending any course where movie film or still photos of the JFK assassination were shown, he said, "Jesus, I don't remember that at all." When he was read Marvin's account of their alleged encounter with the CIA company man, Van Eck said he did not recall the incident. He denied even being at Fort Bragg in August 1965, when he may no longer have been in the military. Nevertheless, he did admit that, while in the Army, he worked undercover in Vietnam in 1964 as a civilian employee, so to speak, at a provincial office of the Agency for International Development. That agency was a CIA front. According to David Van Eck's curriculum vitae, his military duty included special assignment on loan from U.S. Army to the Agency for International Development, South Vietnam, 1964-1965. He was then in Bangkok from 65 to 67 as a civilian, counterinsurgency warfare specialist for advanced research projects in the Agency of Office Secretary of Defense, Thailand Field Unit. Van Eck was apparently well-versed in CIA cover stories and covert warfare. However, when asked if he recognized the name William Bruce Pitzer, he said, "No, not at all." Regardless of who may have been involved in Pitzer's death, Dan Marvin remains convinced that the assignment he turned down at Fort Bragg was carried out by another assassin. For Marvin, the key to William Pitzer's murder was given in the words of the company man under the trees. Yet Marvin did not comprehend their meaning until almost three decades later, when he learned of Pitzer's death. Only when the name of William Bruce Pitzer flashed across Marvin's television screen did he understand that the CIA's designated traitor was in fact a JFK witness, and the enemy to whom Pitzer was preparing to give state secrets was the American people. William Bruce Pitzer is buried at Arlington National Cemetery. Thank you for listening to episode 98 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.